time was 11:20 a.m. on May 8th, 9th? 10th?
Tomorrow's the 11th, that's a good day.
2004. For the record, it is 2004. For the record, we have Representative Chenault, Representative Fate, Representative Foster, myself, Williams, Co-Chair Harris, Vice Chair Meyer, Representative Hocker, and Representative Stoltz present. We do have a quorum. For the record, where are we?
In Juneau.
I think we have a bill to move out of committee. Recommendations on 295.
295?
What the
395?
Where are we? Did we have a
is this one you want to take it up? Yeah. You want me to move it?
Did we have a motion to move that?
Mr. Chairman?
We do have a motion to move it already. Which
it failed. So, Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman? I move that we rescind our action in failing to move from committee CS for Senate Bill 395 amended.
Any objection? Not.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move from committee CS for Senate Bill 395 finance amendment from committee. Individual recommendations attached to this committee.
Not will motion committee with individual recommendations attached to this committee. Next, we'll go to 232, Senate Bill 232, Retirement Teachers and Judges. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please state your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And the bill before you, Committee Substitute Senate Bill 232, is an extremely important piece of legislation for the division. And it ensures tax compliance for the public employees' retirement system, the teachers' retirement system, and the judicial retirement system. And it is extremely important that this bill gain passage, this legislation, or this legislative session. There's an agreement with the IRS right now that we move forward with this. There is a zero fiscal note attached to this bill, and I have with me Anselm Stock, who is our chief financial officer, who has been involved in every aspect of this particular piece of legislation. It has run a course and a review period of 3.5 years. So any questions that you have, we're here to answer those at this time.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the sponsor? Where is the sponsor? The governor's office.
Oh, the finance committee. Request to the
Any,
what do we need from the governor?
Is there any amendments? Are there any amendments to the bill? What's the wish of the committee? Representative Foster.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out SB 232 out of committee with the attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Don't move from committee with individual recommendations attached to fiscal notes. Thank you. Next, we'll go to Senate Bill 292. What did we just do?
Chairman, would that be 392?
392. I'm sorry, yes. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Daniel Patrick Otina. I'm the Senior Assistant Attorney General for Regulatory Affairs. I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General. Mr. Chairman, what I would propose to do is just make 4 points of context and then 4 points of summary and field any questions that you or members of the committee may have, if that would suit you. Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, the 4 points of context for the bill, and I'm not aware of the sponsor summary that you have is a very good and concise summary of the bill in narrative form. But the bill is essentially a follow-on to last year's Executive Order 111. It's a completion of the transfer of authority for public advocacy on utility matters before the RCA, and the authority was transferred via that executive order to the Department of Law. Second of all, Mr. Chairman, by way of context, the underlying theme of the bill is it provides the wherewithal and the ability to execute independently from the RCA. It gives the public advocate that budgetary independence and viability. Third point of context is that, as you note, the fiscal notes before you, this function and the RCA are funded from regulatory cost charge receipts, not general fund. I mean, to that extent, it's off budget. Fourthly, the bill that you have before you is a collaborative work product of all interested parties, including the Department of Law, the RCA, industry, and consumer advocates. With that, Mr. Chairman, by way of backdrop, in summary, the benefits of the bill, it completes the consolidation of public advocacy within the Department of Law, firstly. Secondly, it gives the advocacy function budgetary independence from the RCA. Thirdly, it provides Department of Law advocate with qualified access to utility records as a means of facilitating economical investigation. And finally, it eliminates the inefficiency that exists by exempting state agencies such as the advocate from paying the allocated costs of RCA proceedings. That's the summary of the benefits, Mr. Chairman, and I stand available for questions. Are there any questions or opinions?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We work on the Department of Law budget. This probably should have been part of the discussion at the time, but it certainly wasn't. That's a little bit, it's a big part of the budget, and I know there's no motivation like a bureaucrat that needs to save his job, so I know why we're here today. And you've put a lot of personal work in here because you're the guy who's on the line not to have a job. So let's get the public policy stuff out of the way and let's get right down to what it is. And I just want to make that on the record. This should have been part of the budget process. I'm upset that it wasn't. And that's not a good signal from the Department of Law how things are happening here. And that's, I'll leave it at that. And I think that's my message on the table.
Any more comments or questions?
We get a response from the.
Okay. Get a response.
To Representative Stolte's comment? Yes. Well, I'm not sure I can appreciate your concern, I suppose, but I'm not sure if it's misplaced or not.
You can keep arguing about it, and I'll just discuss it later next year. That's fine. I've said my point.
Well, let me follow this, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I can know.
Representative Harris.
Is your job on the line if this bill doesn't pass?
No, it is not.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, all right. The funding source for the public advocacy, the authority for public advocacy has already been transferred. The funding source is currently regulatory cost charge receipts. It's just that in the current scenario, the Department of Law's public advocacy function is an RDU within the RCA budget, funded from regulatory cost charge receipts. So this bill does not salary my position or those that are likewise responsible for the function. What this bill does is provides the appropriate independence of the budget for the now Department of Law's public advocacy function. There's no change in the source of the funding, Mr. Chairman.
Can you tell me, I think the answer, can you tell me why this particular issue was not brought up at, when the Department of Law's budget was being considered?
I don't know that I'm in a position to be able to answer that accurately, but I want to be responsive, and I would only, I suppose, conjecture that it's not a general fund funded function. It's a regulatory cost charge receipt function, and I suppose that's really the best I could offer you.
Let me explain one thing to you. You mentioned something which my ears always perk up when they say it's off budget. I'm not sure you all know what off budget means, because there is nothing off budget. We take into account everything. Now, we certainly have general funds, which are funds, that come in from oil and gas revenues and other things like that. And then we have funds which are receipts for services type of a thing. They're an even up swift swap so that they're not, they balance, the service that's provided is paid for by somebody. So they're all on budget. So we do take all that into consideration, believe me, but when you say it's off budget, it really isn't. That's a term that we use. I don't think it's a term you all ought to use. Well, everything you do is on budget, part of it.
And I don't take issue with that, Mr. Chairman. Probably in an artful use on my part, but recall, I'm not the administrative officer. I'm really the substantive guy, if you will. It's my responsibility to implement the advocacy function on behalf of consumers before the RCA.
I'm going to support your bill here, but I just thought I'd throw that in.
I appreciate it.
I would like to bring a little bit.
Any other discussion or questions on the bill? Not listening to questions.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out SB 392 out of committee with the attached fiscal note within the budget recommendation.
Any objection? Last bill moved from committee with individual recommendation, attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we'll take up 393.
Just take permanent fund dividends from university students.
Scary title, isn't it?
Senator, welcome back.
I'm trying to get him to run again so he can get a seat here, but he won't do it.
I second that motion.
Do you live
in that district?
Representative Faith's chair was just right.
Mr. Chairman, he's got a brother that does live in my district.
Poor guy. Senator?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, SB 393 adds the university to the list of exemptions for permanent fund dividends to be taken when there are debts owed to the state. When a debt is owed to the state, there is a criterion statute by which it can be collected. When it was first enacted into statute, it said an agency of the state may do thus and such, and it lists that out. I think the intent at the time was to include the university as a state agency, but the university does enjoy and suffer under a vague distinction between when it is a state agency and when it is not. This bill clarifies that the purposes of collecting bad debt, tuition, parking fees, those kinds of things that occur at the university, that we can be considered a state agency and collect someone's permanent fund dividend. There is, in our own policy, protections built in for notice and there is also protection built into the statute. We anticipate from the fiscal note that you see that this will allow us to collect about $400,000 this year. The first year that we do this, it's going to cost us about $100,000 this year to set that up, and then about $30,000 per year after that to collect these fees. It will not come out of general fund. It will come out of the university receipts. It will pay for it. The program should pay for it.
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another state agency that comes to mind is child support. Are there any other state agencies that have this type of power or authority?
If you look in the bill on line 22, H2, the statute is fairly broad in that. This is a debt owed by an eligible individual to an agency of the state. I'm not sure it gets down into the specific agencies. The only reason the university, we request that the university be added is that it could be interpreted that the university was specifically not included in that, and then someone could contest that we have the right to collect their dividend check.
Representative Croft, can you?
Why can't we collect under 5, a writ of execution? Sort of following up while he's considering that, I take it the difference between 5 and 6 is that you have to go through the expense of a small claims action and get the judgment, whereas there's some quicker procedure allowed to the state that they just had an administrative appeal and where an ordinary citizen couldn't simply garnish the dividend without the whole court process, the state can do it through its administrative appeal.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that is correct, that 5 is what you had described through small claims court or some other procedure. When you get into the other list, it is administrative and it is laid out in statute. It is a quick procedure.
You guys would anticipate having your own policy mirroring or being similar to that, not being under that state statute of the procedures you would have to use in an administrative sense to collect the debt?
Chairman, the procedures are in statute, which we would obviously follow. We also have our own policies, which are actually more strict.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harris.
The question I had, Pete, was, have you run this by, or has there been any kind of opinion by the student body there at the university, or the student councils, or whatever they are, that they may have? Have they given a position on it, or has that not come across their radar screen?
Mr. Chairman, no, it hasn't. The timing on this hasn't.
I think it's a good idea.
Any other questions? Positive.
I'll go ahead and move out SB 393. This is like the hunt I'm done with dogs beat Kelly Bell with the attached fiscal note within the budget recommendation.
Any objection? Mm-hmm. If not, bill moves from committee with individual recommendation. Next, we'll take up Senate Bill 224.
Morning. Thank you. For the record, I'm Richard Schmitz. I work for Senator John Cowdery, and I ask for support for Senate Bill 224. I have with me Cindy Cashin with the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and we should come up and get the chair's permission, of course. Essentially, what this does is this bill fills a gap that exists today. Between people who get DWIs, which is, you know, you could be 14 years old or 84 years old. If you're driving with a blood alcohol content over 0.08, then you're driving drunk. And that's in and of itself is a whole, it's sort of a separate matter. And there's penalties and procedures that go there. It's also illegal to be drinking when you're under the age of 21. And that's something that's national policy, and people feel that's a good thing. This covers people who choose to drive after drinking alcohol when they're under 21. In other words, after drinking alcohol illegally. It's been a testimony in a number of committees from Cindy, who represents the various MAD chapters in the state, that this has always been kind of something that gets a little bit pushed through the system kind of fast. This is a behavior that leads to adult DWIs. So we're trying to figure the purpose of the bill is to try to put a brakes on this early. And it does so by mandating a $500 fine for the first offense and mandatory community service. And I would really ask that if you have questions to ask Cindy. Second offense goes up to 1,000 with an increase in mandatory community service, and the third or more offenses, it's $1,500. The idea is to take real cash out of people's pocketbooks and not to just have these things kind of dismissed and passed over.
Could we add anything, Cindy?
That's what I, yeah.
Currently what's happening is that the teenagers are being charged with MOVACs and minor consuming charges. The public defender's office come out and said that this will increase their workload, when in reality, the majority, almost all of the MOVACs and minor consuming charges already have the right to a public defender. When you have a minor consuming charge, you have that right. So it will not change that much, not significantly. The majority of MOVACs that walk out of the courtroom have a $250 fee, which to them is literally a joke. I have seen too many kids in the courtrooms walking out laughing because their parents are just going to pay it off. $250, unfortunately, is not that much anymore. And they rack it up and up and up. And each time they accrue these MOVACs, that's all it is. It stays at $250 and nothing else happens. By the time they've got their third or fourth MOVAC, they become an adult and then move up into the DUIs. And what we see is their BAC level, their blood alcohol content level, raising with each charge. And what they've become is they become familiar with the system, excuse me, and they become our high-risk drunk drivers. This bill will detour them, because the first one would be 500, the second MOVAC would be 1,000, and the third one would be 1,500. And what that does is that affects mom and dad at home, or the legal guardian at home, and then they talk about it. They talk about at home what is going on. It's a situation that is uncomfortable enough to where it's brought up. And the community work service hours is very important, because it makes the teenager have to work with a community work service program that deals with the education, treatment, and intervention of alcohol abuse. And we have teenagers that come in and work with us because of community work service hours for minor consuming charges. And we love working with them. We've had enjoyable experiences with all of them, and they've all walked away hopefully changed, hopefully thinking, you know, against making that bad choice the next time it comes across their path. Community work service does work. We've seen it happen in other nonprofit programs as well. This is a very good bill for our teenagers. This is good for them.
Jim?
We have Schultz.
I have just a real quick question, Mr. Chairman. Maybe Representative Croft, who has a broader breadth of experience with youth courts, is this change in the law, is it increasing the penalty with this, will change the eligibility for applicability for first-time youthful offenders to get into the youth court program as a first-time offender diversion, Mr. Schmitz or whoever?
Through the chair, Representative Schultz. Youth court, to my understanding, is 14 to 16-year-olds, and it has to be only their first MC. I believe after that, they're no longer eligible for youth court.
Maybe Mr. Schmitz can answer my question, which was a little different. Is the increase of the penalty, would this have any create any barrier to it?
I can't answer that directly. I've... I asked about youth court when I did some of my work on the bill, and I think, if I'm correct, I may be wrong, but I believe my understanding was is that different municipalities, or the way they work a little differently sometimes, depending on what kind of what they, you know, like some youth courts have jury trials, some don't, and this may be a possibility in some cases, but I believe it's not in most.
Mr. Chair, maybe you can just try to get me a more definitive answer before the floor, if that's possible. I know the committee's busy, so we'll stop this line. Later is fine for me.
We have Linda Wilson. She's with the Public Defender's Office. I guess she wouldn't know what this is about.
If I had to answer the question straight out, and this is the answer that I've gotten most, although it wasn't absolutely definitive, was no. This takes people out of youth court.
Takes people. I've heard two answers.
In other words, they're not eligible for it to begin with, or it doesn't put them in or take them out. They're not eligible for youth. It's not a youth court offense.
Yeah,
three
answers.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this only applies to 0.02 to 0.08, or...
It actually,
if
I understand it correctly, a MOVAC is if you're at a party and you're caught drinking, you know, so you get a minor consuming, and you go home and sleep and get up at 8, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning and drive to work, and the same policeman, let's say, happens to spot you driving, you can get a MOVAC because you've driven within 24 hours of consuming alcohol. So the blood alcohol content isn't a factor in a MOVAC.
I guess either question or comment. And that is only if you received a minor consuming at the party?
Well, I use it as
and the only reason I go there is because you may have some kids that go to a party that weren't drinking, and
right.
then
I don't
you stop them at 10 o'clock in the morning,
right?
But knew they were at a party, and you're going to try to get
no, I think you got to have some. You would have to have proof. You got to have proof that they were consuming alcohol. Otherwise,
it
wouldn't
apply. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of this. Most of them are indeterminate. I think the reason why they're indeterminate is because once you go to community service, then they're eligible for a jury trial.
And you can answer that.
Through the chair, Representative Meyer, that is correct. Right now they're not. However, the majority, almost all of the MOVACs, are additionally charged with minor consuming, which does allow you to have a jury. So you're already charged with another charge, which you already have that choice.
I do like the community service aspect of it. I think that's probably the best thing we can do for the kids. That's all I have. Thank you.
Representative
Tate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this provision waived in the event that a minor is takes a glass of wine with the family and his own home, something of this nature?
It wouldn't be specifically, I don't think there's any way to put that in statute. I think it would be if someone was caught drinking illegally.
Through the chair, Representative Fate, you can give your child alcohol. It's legal.
That wasn't the question. If this act, through the chair, if this child was consuming with the family and had a glass of wine and went out and got in an accident with no relationship to the amount of consumption of alcohol, and the officer comes along to the accident and does a breathalyzer or some other thing, and this minor is found to have this, what happens?
I think that we would get a MOVAC, yeah.
They would be charged because they were a minor operating a vehicle after consumption. And they were a minor, well, they wouldn't get minor consuming, but they would get a MOVAC.
Thank you.
And fortunately, they would not have killed someone.
Representative Harris?
Maybe Representative Croft. I'm on top of the fiscal note. Maybe Representative Croft.
Representative Croft? Yeah.
And the minor here is under 21?
Yeah, we went through that in judiciary, and actually I had a, it's kind of like a quote-unquote term of art. It's applied in drinking and driving statutes. So the statute for drinking and driving or for is a minor, it's included someone under 21 or under, or age under age 21.
Whereas so, normally in the statutes it's under 18.
Right, and that's specifically kind of set out for that. So this applies to that part, not to the part of a minor being 18.
One more, I'm sorry. So section thanks, is repealed and reenacted. So there was a minor operating a vehicle after consuming MOVAC. Took me a while to figure out what you're talking about, Cindy. There was one before, and we're just increasing the penalties, or we're for the first time defining this crime?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, we're increasing the penalties, the fines, and we're also making community work service mandatory. And it's community work service that's related to the education and prevention intervention of alcohol abuse. Because sometimes when community work service is handed out, they end up mopping the floor of some place that's totally unrelated. They don't get anything out of it.
What other substantive changes does it make to the MOVAC crime besides just increasing the and changing the character of the penalties? Does it do anything else?
Doesn't make any other changes.
Thank you.
Representative Jewell?
Thank you. The community service that's in here also gets to prevention or treatment or education related to. Is that going to be mandatory, the education, prevention, or treatment to? And as part of that?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, the community work service program that they would sign up to work for would need to have some type of work program related to that. It could also be something that's done through the schools as well. It's liberally defined so that the youth has a variety of places to rack up the community work service hours. We're trying to make this as easy as possible for them to find a place they're comfortable in. We don't want to restrict them to only one kind of service available.
It came up in other committee that, you know, if, for example, it was in a village or rural area that they could, you know, a magistrate could speak with a group of elders and could, you know, establish a program for them to follow. It doesn't have to be. It has to be something that can be worked out. It doesn't have to be kind of an official training program. It could be something that would be appropriate, and the magistrate can decide that. The idea would be to get them to work in the community and to learn something. Perhaps they could, you know, care for someone who's been a victim of, you know, drunk driving or an alcoholism problem or whatever.
Representative Harris.
Thanks, Chairman. Can you explain the fiscal note?
Well, there's a whole bunch of indeterminate ones, which
I'm less concerned about that. I'm more
which
concerned
the
about
one this. The one from the public defenders, and you know, we've gone around about that a little bit, and I pass it up to Cindy Cashin because she's done a lot of court watching and other things, and it's her belief that it would not increase that much, the amount of work that the public defenders say it will.
They really don't need another body.
They ask a lot of, you know, they, and one of the examples is when we originally had the bill, it was going to be a Class B misdemeanor, and we got rid of that because it creates all kinds of problems that were hard to follow, and the fiscal note stayed the same. So this lowers it down, puts it in front of magistrates, does not make it a misdemeanor.
Chairman. Chairman, I'd like to move that on fiscal note number 10, that we zero it out, as well as the position.
Any Representative Stoltz?
I just want to get on the record that it's Mad's opinion that that's probably an appropriate action.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, which action would be appropriate?
It's that the public defender's office is adequately staffed and this won't provide an undue burden on their current activities.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, that is a very good question. I believe that the entire courtroom could have to do with some more staff, including the public defender's office. However, I don't believe this is the way to do it, and I don't believe that this bill will increase their workload enough to require another person.
Thank you.
Reality is, under this department, if they're required by the courts to do business, they're going to end up doing it, and they'll come back to us for a supplemental. So I would rather face the supplemental later than have to worry about it at this point in time with a fiscal note. So.
We do have someone from the public defender's office, if you want to listen to them.
Sure. I don't think that changed my mind, but that's all right.
That's what I was asking. Yeah. Had somebody from the public
defender. Do we have
Linda Wilson?
Do we have the public defenders online?
Yeah.
Excuse me. Could you stand by for a minute?
I was just asking whether we had the public defenders online here.
Linda, could you state your name and who you represent, please?
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm pushing the mute button. This is Linda Wilson, Deputy Director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. Thank you for allowing me to respond to some of the questions about our fiscal note. There is a difference in our fiscal note is supported. Let me explain a little bit. Currently, when a person is charged with MOVAC under the current law, primarily what happens is they get their license revoked. There's another provision under Title 28 that allows for an administrative revocation of your license. And that's primarily what happens to these charges. They do not get charged in court very often for minor operating a vehicle after consumption. They get their license administratively revoked and the DAs don't pursue this charge. By amending the statute and requiring mandatory community work service and increased graduated fines, these will now be prosecuted in court. They're not all charged in addition to minor consuming. There are circumstances where they would go for a MOVAC because they want the license revocation and would not be charged with minor consuming. For a first minor consuming charge, you don't get any license action because there's no tie-in with the consuming with the driving. In a minor operating a vehicle after consuming or a MOVAC, there is. What I can tell you in the past that has happened when the legislature changed the statute on concerning minor consuming, there was a belief that by calling it an infraction, the minor would not be entitled to court-appointed counsel. As a result, in 2001, when that statute changed, there were 58 cases charged that were assigned to the public defender for minor consuming. That number has mushroomed in 2003 to 892. So if MOVAC, and it's not just minor operating a vehicle, there are three statutes now that have graduated sanctions and mandatory community work service. It's MOVAC, it's refusal to do a breath test when you stop, and it's also driving 24 hours after you've been cited for MOVAC. So these are three new offenses that are going to be charged where they're going to be entitled to court-appointed counsel and a jury trial, and they're going to get a fair amount of them are going to be the public defenders. Excuse me, changing it from a misdemeanor to an infraction doesn't negate your entitlement to court-appointed counsel or a jury trial because of the mandatory community work service that is part of this bill. So we will need one additional attorney to handle this. We will need at least handle this new caseload. I please ask you not to zero out our system note. It is supported by what is presented in this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for heard right now. Linda, any questions? Thank you, Linda. If you could stay online, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is any, I'll object is for further discussion purposes on the amendment to zero out the fiscal note.
Yeah, and very briefly, I'll just object on the merits. I mean, I think this will cost this much and will cost have this extra person that will be needed. It's probably appropriate that we do it. We always play this with the with OPA and PD's budget, where it's sort of conservatively estimated, and then there's usually big supplementals. And I think it doesn't give an accurate picture of that department's ongoing needs. I wish we'd come closer to stopping it. And this is sort of a mini effort at that. We either believe or don't believe that this will take some more time. And if it does, that's what fiscal notes on bills are for, to give us an idea of what the things we're doing are costing. It's appropriate that we do it. It's a good bill that will cost some money to implement. And I don't think we should ignore that. I don't think it does the public any good, and I don't think it's the right thing for finance to do. This is an appropriate bill that'll cost a little money.
Any other discussion on the amendment? I'll remove my objection. Any other discussion on the amendment? Representative Croft, you have told
no.
No objection? Amendment's adopted. Is there any more discussion on the bill?
I'll go ahead and move out SB224 out of committee as amended within the virtual recommendation.
Any objection? We'll move from committee with individual
recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was 4.4 or whatever.
Next, we'll pick up Senate Bill 376.
Jason Hooley, staff of Senator Dyson. I'll give you a real brief overview, then I'll step aside and let you talk to the experts. Senate Bill 376 allows the Departments of Health and Social Services and Department of Revenue issue subpoenas in their investigations of suspected public assistance fraud and permanent fund dividend fraud. Currently, when suspected fraud is when fraud is suspected, the departments have to engage the judicial system to acquire the subpoenas, which becomes quickly prohibitively expensive in terms of time and money and resources. So allowing them to issue their own subpoenas in the cases of PFD fraud and public assistance fraud will allow them to better combat fraud.
Any questions? Any comments? Any amendments? Representative Foster.
I'll go ahead and move out SB376 out of committee with the attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Chenault.
I'll object just to make a comment. My only concern with this, and I've talked with the department, is simply who's in charge of that subpoena power. That I think that we need to make a statement that we want it to be at the commissioner level. We don't want this to filter down to the employee level where it can be used in any form or fashion as retribution against anybody for problems that they may have with the department. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
Before we move it, John.
You have, He doesn't want any coffee, Denny.
Jay Marley, did you have any comments? We're about to move the bill.
Yes, sir. The Department of Labor, I just came from the Department of Labor, and that subpoena power is down to the investigator level. The number of subpoenas that we'd be issuing would it'd be extremely burdensome and time-consuming to have to try on the commissioner or deputy commissioner or even the division director's time to have to get a signature from them on every single subpoena that we'd issue. The whole idea of the subpoena power is to expedite the investigation, trial investigation process, and to save time and money for everybody involved. And it hasn't been seen as a abuse in other divisions or other departments.
Okay. Representative Stoltz has a question or a comment.
I have a comment will be followed by a question. I thought the burden we were trying to take away was having to go to the court system for every one of these. I can't believe it's going to be a burden to get the commissioner's signature. Is that, Mr. Lombardi, is that the department's position on your side?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, no, it's really not. In fact, if I can speak to the action that happened in the Senate, there was some discussion regarding the potential abuse of this, as Representative Chenault has noted. And as a result of that, there was a floor amendment that was proposed by Senator Hollis French that this be limited to the commissioner's level or the director's level. That essentially we reserve this at an executive level where there was some accountability for the subpoena issuance. And we agreed that that was appropriate. We were willing to live with that as a limitation, that it was more important that we were able to do this administratively and avoid either the necessity of going to the AG's office or the judicial system to do this. So we're good with that. We helped craft that floor amendment, and we're more than willing to live within those constraints.
Thank you. I mean, that's good to hear. That last comment kind of bothered me a little bit, that I'm willing to take this step as long as there is somebody that that has directly under the governor. And this is a serious measure. And I support the welfare fraud efforts, including last year's bill. And was this just an afterthought that this wasn't included in that? Or is it too hot a potato and want to be kept separately? Or?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair. You mean the limitation on authority level, or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, last year there was a major welfare fraud bill that passed. And was this considered during that process?
No, we discovered in March that we had not omitted to get any kind of security power to make sure that we could engage in this effort.
Any other comments or questions for? Is any objection to moving the bill? If not, the bill moves from committee with individual recommendations. Tap the fiscal note.
True.
Stand at ease for a few minutes here. Pete, as you know, the cigarette tax is up for the committee this morning or this afternoon. We have not received the CS to move forward as of yet. Hopefully, sometime this afternoon, we'll get the CS and call ourselves back in and move the bill up. There has been negotiations done on this bill, and I think we've reached an agreement. So,
can you give us a hint, Mr. Chairman?
Can you tell us what the agreement is?
I don't have it.
Like a dollar and a half a pack.
I don't have it in front of me as of yet.
Well, I thought you moved it all to cigars.
Yeah, including all cigars, and municipalities can pile on the whole bit.
So, with that, I don't think we have any other bills to be heard. Nothing. Okay. So we will stand in recess to the College Chair.